Hello, everyone. Welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, September 14th. The month is just flying by. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Glad to have you listening, as always. It's been kind of a cloudy day in Fort Dodge. The sun snuck out for a look earlier today, but has since gone away. We have overcast skies and temperatures in the low 70s. It cools off quite a bit at night. It's supposed to warm up this weekend, but we'll talk about that as we conclude our time together when we look at a more detailed forecast. Looking at the front page of the Messenger, preparing for change is the title of the first article. The city purchases properties on the northwest side. There's a picture in the Messenger of a lone vehicle near the intersection of 3rd Avenue Northwest and 8th Street Northwest. The stretch of 3rd Avenue Northwest will have a different look by this time next year after the buildings are demolished. The City Council on Monday approved numerous land purchases in the 3rd Avenue Northwest corridor Monday. Some were made to clear land for future development. Other purchases were made to acquire land needed for realigning the street. About $740,000 worth of property on the northwest side of Fort Dodge was purchased by the City Council Monday as the first step to transforming the 3rd Avenue Northwest corridor. Some of that property was purchased so that it can be cleared to make way for future development. Other parcels were bought to provide land needed for the realignment of the road at the top of the hill where Hawkeye Avenue becomes 3rd Avenue Northwest. The buildings on all those properties will be demolished this winter, according to Vicki Reek, the city's Director of Economic and Community Development. The biggest single purchase was from Lynette Peterson of Fort Dodge. The city bought 3 houses, 3 commercial buildings, and 3 vacant lots from her for $400,000. She will remove 2 of the houses and 1 of the commercial buildings before the sale is closed. The council also bought 1 house and 1 commercial building from Donald Peterson of Fort Dodge for $105,000. Since he runs a business from the commercial building, he will be eligible for up to $70,000 for relocation expenses. The money to pay for the purchases from both Petersons will come from a general obligation bond issue. All of the property bought from both Lynette Peterson and Donald Peterson is located on 3rd Avenue Northwest between 8th Street Northwest and Amvets Drive. All of that land was bought to make space for future development. 5 properties were purchased to accommodate the realignment of the road. These properties were bought for that purpose, 609 and 619 3rd Avenue Northwest. 609 from Julie Isaacson for $20,000. 619 from Jim Kesterson for $67,200. 217 7th Street Northwest from Ruby Stolp for $63,000. 122nd Street Northwest from Randy Connell and Belinda Dorman for $46,800. 222 7th Street Northwest from Robert Hogan for $38,200. The money to pay for those purchases will come from the local option sales tax and sanitary sewer revenue. Councilman Andy Fritz was absent from the otherwise unanimous vote to purchase the properties. The money needed to build a municipal broadband system was borrowed by the Fort Dodge City Council Monday. Construction of the system, which will be capable of bringing fiber optic cable to every address in the city, is expected to start next summer. The City Council on Monday voted to borrow $33,355,000 from a group of financial institutions led by Bank Iowa in Humboldt. That money will pay for the materials and construction of the system. The other financial institutions involved are United Bank of Iowa and Fort Dodge, Green State Credit Union, Fort Dodge, First State Bank, Fort Dodge, Great Western Bank, Fort Dodge, Security Savings Bank, Gallery, and Cedar Rapids Bank and Trust. Interest rates on the loan range from 2.75% to 5.25%. An additional $3.48 million is being borrowed from the People's Credit Union and Fort Dodge to pay for the initial operating costs of the system. Interest rates on that loan range from 3.5% to 5.25%. Both loans will be paid off with revenue from the broadband system. The loan agreement will be payable solely and only from the net revenues of the municipal telecommunications utility of the city. Ryan Mayle, the assistant to the city manager, wrote in a report to the council. Councilman Andrew Fritz was absent from the otherwise unanimous vote on the loans. The drive to create a municipal broadband utility began in November 2019. with a referendum on giving the local government the authority to establish one. That referendum measure was approved with 71.6% voting yes. More than a year of meetings and planning followed that vote. In July, the council moved from planning to implementing. That month, it approved the procedural steps needed to launch the process that resulted in Monday's borrowing. In July, the council also hired Howard R. Green Company of Cedar Rapids to prepare the final plans for the system at a cost of $1.7+ million. The council also set prices for the service, $75 a month for residential service with upload and download speeds of 100 megabits per second, $95 a month for residential service with upload and download speeds of up to 1,000 megabits per second, $20 per phone line per month for residential phone service, $100 a month for business service with upload and download speeds of up to 100 megabits per second, $250 a month for business service with upload and download speeds of 200 megabits per second, $500 a month for business service with upload and download speeds of 1,000 megabits per second, and $75 per month per phone line for business service. The school board has approved a plan to help students who sustained learning loss. The Fort Dodge Community School District Board of Education approved a plan Monday evening to help support students in the district who sustained learning loss due to COVID-19 and distance learning. The ESSER 3 plan will employ funds and guidance from the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund, known as ESSER, released by the United States Department of Education in April. According to the plan, the school district leadership teams analyzed Iowa statewide assessment of student progress data, student results from the Conditions for Learning Survey, literacy and math screening, and progress monitoring data and behavioral referral data to determine the needs of students in order to best address those needs with these funds. Based on this research, the plan states they found the groups most impacted by COVID-19 to be students from low-income families, students of color, or from a particular ethnic group, students with disabilities, English learners, students experience homelessness, children and youth in foster care, and migrant students. The ESSER 3 funds will be used in a variety of ways across the district. Superintendent Derek Joel said, "Our allocation estimate is about $1.7 million in that fund. We're looking at differentiation coordinator, summer school, Leader in Me, which is a social emotional curriculum and initiative by the district. In addition, the plan lists several other implementations, such as use of evidence-based accelerated learning interventions in literacy, math, and social-emotional behavior, an online platform to provide flexible or accelerated learning opportunities, and staff to oversee this platform. Literacy Paris, English language learner teachers and tutors, and extended learning opportunities after the school day, a dyslexia specialist, an intervention teacher, a nurse to provide evidence-based health and mitigation learning opportunities." Joel said they have built many staff members into this plan, but were unable to fill all the positions. "What we're trying to do is just balance what the needs are that we are seeing as a result of online learning and COVID-19 in general," he said. "Then what supports can we put in place and cover under the learning loss domain?" The board approved the ESSER 3 plan unanimously, except for Matt Moritz, who was absent. The board also approved a request from Kirsten Doble, Director of Secondary Education Services, and Steph Anderson, Director of Elementary Education Services. The request was to spend $30,000 for support for both building and district leadership to develop a multi-tiered system of supports for pre-kindergarten to high school seniors. The professional development instruction will come from a company called West Ed. Kirsten and I have been investigating how we can better support both the behavioral side and the academic side of our MTSS structure within the schools, and really building a systemic approach to that instead of one school doing something one way and another school doing another way," Anderson said. Anderson explained that this professional development would help develop a system that would be the same across the district as to how students are receiving support, and how they determine when a student no longer needs extra support. They received bids from two companies, West Ed and Better Lesson, and chose the slightly less expensive West Ed plan. The board approved the request unanimously. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, parking rules get final approval in Fort Dodge. That will be the title of the next article. Weeks after the parking meters were removed from downtown streets, the Fort Dodge City Council on Monday gave final approval to a new parking regulations. Here are the highlights of the new rule. The on-street spaces, once guarded by meters, are available for free parking for up to 2 hours. Parking in the downtown lots is free on nights, weekends, and holidays. Parking is prohibited on downtown streets from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. every day. Additionally, the council has already approved new prices for permits to be used in the lots. Those prices are $22 per month for daytime parking, $30 per month for 24-hour parking, and $40 per month for a reserve space that can be used every day all year. The parking regulations received final approval on a 5-1 vote. Council members Kim Allstott, Nevin Conrad, Dave Flattery, Terry Minke, and Lydia Scher voted yes. Councilman Jeff Halter voted no. He said he is opposed to banning parking on downtown streets from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, our next article is entitled Urban Deer. Not really an article, but a picture in today's Messenger that shows several deer spotted snacking on shrubbery outside a home in the 500 block of North 2nd Street Monday evening. And those little critters are all over the place. We will head back to the main page of the Messenger. I'll click where it says More Local News, and we'll see if there's anything there that needs to be read. Let's take a look next at From Our Files. From Our Files takes us back to 2006, 15 short years ago. There's a picture of Special Agent Mike Morris, who was leading the Iowa Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, talking about ways to protect children from internet predators. Morris was the keynote speaker at a forum hosted by State Senator Daryl Beal, a Democrat from Fort Dodge at Fort Dodge Senior High. And that is From Our Files, going back 15 short years ago to 2006. We'll take a quick look at the news of record next. Magistrate Court on Wednesday, violation of no contact order, Terry Bass of Fort Dodge, 30 days in jail, all but 7 suspended, fined $60. Failure to appear at arraignment, Kerry Johnson of Fort Dodge, transferred to district court. Also driving while barred, Mr. Johnson, preliminary hearing set for October 1st. Failure to stop in an assured clear distance, driving under suspension, no insurance, Robert Leadham of Fort Dodge, no insurance, failure to appear, 615-63, driving under suspension, and failure to stop, also failure to appear, they are charged $175, excuse me. Speeding, Akima Rian of Fort Dodge, fined $193, no valid driver's license, Akia Rian, fined $354. OWI, Sean Stowe of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and Open Container, Sean Stowe also continued 180 days on the Open Container, and preliminary hearing set for September 23rd on the OWI. Friday, police logs reflect an unknown problem in the 100 block of North 10th Street, car accident 400 block North 22nd. Trespassing 10 block North 25th, theft 600 block North 23rd, and the 1600 block of North 27th. A car accident 1400 block 20th Avenue North, missing juvenile 200 block Avenue M West. A request to remove a subject 3200 block 5th Avenue South. Harassment 2000 block of Highway 169. A fight in the 3100 block of North 15th Street. Suspicious person South 15th Street, 3rd Avenue South. Theft, 800 block South 32nd Street. Suspicious person, 2nd Avenue South and South 3rd Street. A car accident, North 22nd Street and 2nd Avenue North. Trespassing, 600 block Central Avenue. Theft, 200 block Avenue M West. A robbery, 800 block South 22nd Street. A fight at Avenue C and K Street. Unknown problem, 10th Avenue North and North 19th Street.
Request to remove subject, 300 block Avenue O West. Suspicious vehicle, 2900 block of 25th Avenue North. Unknown problem, 3000 block 1st Avenue South. Fight, 1600 block 3rd Avenue South. Shots fired, 1200 block 1st Avenue North. Harassment, 1400 block 5th Avenue South. Shots fired, 300 block 10th Avenue North. And a suspicious vehicle, 3rd Street Northwest and 9th Avenue Northwest. On Saturday, unknown problem, 1400 block Central Avenue, shots fired, 10 block North 10th Street. A domestic call was reported, unresponsive subject, 20 block of North 12th Street. Suspicious vehicle, 300 block South 19th, suspicious person, 1400 block Central Avenue. Suspicious vehicle, 1400 block 4th Avenue South. Theft, 900 block South 13th Street Southwest. Suspicious person, 1400 block 4th Avenue South, a stabbing in the 800 block of Kenya Road. Criminal mischief, 600 block North 10th Street, theft, 400 block North 5th Street. Harassment, 300 block 4th Street Northwest, trespassing, 1300 block of 2nd Avenue North. Theft in the 3300 block of 5th Avenue South, an unknown problem in the 1400 block of 4th Avenue South. Criminal mischief, North 8th Street, 3rd Avenue North. Domestic call was reported. Fight, 1400 block 5th Avenue South. Car accident, 100 block South 29th Street. Suspicious person, 5th Avenue South and South 16th. Suspicious person, 1200 block 1st Avenue South. And another one, 900 block 3rd Avenue South. Criminal mischief, 300 block 13th Street Northwest. Runaway, 300 block of Avenue M West. Trespassing, South 25th Street, 1st Avenue South. Suspicious persons, 3rd Avenue South and South 16th Street, 100 block South 25th Street. Car accident, 2600 block 16th Avenue North. Request to remove a subject, 3000 block 5th Avenue South. Unknown problem, 3000 block 1st Avenue South. Suspicious person, 1600 block North 30th Street. A domestic call, a civil problem, 1100 block 4th Avenue North. Fireworks, 900 block 3rd Avenue North, a domestic call, and a request to remove a subject in the 900 block of Central Avenue. On Sunday, an assault was reported in the 1200 block of South 22nd Street. Fireworks, 2000 block 2nd Avenue North. Unknown problem, 600 block South 12th Street. Domestic call was reported. Another unknown problem, 1500 block 3rd Avenue Northwest. Violation of a no-contact order, 700 block 1st Avenue South, theft in the 1700 block of Fort North 14th Street, a domestic call, criminal mischief, 2000 block 4th Avenue South. Two more domestic calls were reported, a violation of a no-contact order, 1300 block 8th Avenue South, juvenile problems, 1200 block 4th Avenue North, unknown problem, 2000 block 4th Avenue North, suspicious persons, 300 block 6th Avenue North and 2nd Avenue North and North 22nd Street. Harassment in the 100 block of Avenue M West, a fight in the 100 block of Avenue M West, a car accident in 2500 block of 5th Avenue South, a fight was in the 300 block of North 13th Street, a hit and run, 3300 block 5th Avenue South, a car accident, Avenue F and B Street, criminal mischief, 400 block North 2nd Street, out of control subject, 1100 block of Avenue B, civil problem, 2100 block of 4th Avenue North. Unknown problem, 1100 block of Avenue B. Car accident, 9th and a half Avenue South and South 23rd Street. Juvenile problems, 1000 block Cooper Drive. Runaway, 300 block Avenue M West. Suspicious person, Prospect Avenue and South 15th Street. Suspicious vehicle, 10 block of Museum Road. Juvenile problems were reported. Harassment in the 300 block of 4th Street Northwest. And a car accident in the 200 block of 2nd Street Northwest. That is the Fort Dodge Police Log and the Magistrate Court for Webster County. We have some breaking news that has just been presented on the Messenger website. A Fort Dodge man is facing multiple felony charges after leading law enforcement on a pursuit that ended in a cornfield in Hamilton County early Tuesday morning. According to the Webster County Sheriff's Office, Blaine Stockwell, 37, was driving a 2010 black Cadillac CTS near 290th Street and Sampson Avenue in Webster County. At about 12:51 a.m., a Webster County Sheriff's deputy attempted a traffic stop. That's when Stockwell allegedly refused to stop and led the deputy on a pursuit through the southern part of Webster County in the Brushy Creek area. Later, Stockwell's vehicle struck a stop stick deployed by a Hamilton County Sheriff's deputy. The vehicle was disabled near 290th Street and Stagecoach Road in Hamilton County. At 1:03 a.m., Stockwell drove the Cadillac into a cornfield where both he and the passenger fled on foot into the corn, police reported. According to the police, the driver refused commands to stop and was pursued on foot by the deputy. The deputy used their taser to subdue Stockwell. He was subsequently taken into custody. A perimeter was set up around the field by law enforcement, but the passenger was not located. Stockwell is charged with felony eluding, a Class C felony, felony possession of a controlled substance, a Class D felony, driving while barred, habitual offender, an aggravated misdemeanor, possession of marijuana, a serious misdemeanor, interference with official acts, a simple misdemeanor, fraudulent use of registration, a simple misdemeanor, and operating a non-registered vehicle, a simple misdemeanor. Stockwell is being held in the Webster County Jail on $32,000 cash bond. The incident remains under investigation. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact the Webster County Sheriff's Office or Webster County Crime Stoppers by calling or anonymously at 515-573-1444. The Webster County Sheriff's Office was assisted in this investigation by the Boone County Sheriff's Office, Hamilton County Sheriff's Office, and the Fort Dodge Police Department. We're going to head over next to the Messenger editorial page. Now more than ever, our global war on terrorism, the veterans deserve recognition. And this is a column written by U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. As a company commander who served in Kuwait and Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom, and someone who spent 23 years of my life serving in the United States military alongside some of the best and brightest our country has to offer, the last few weeks have been extremely difficult to watch. President Biden's hasty and haphazard withdrawal has led to the disastrous collapse of Afghanistan, abandoning our own citizens and putting our allies in harm's way. I've heard from so many service members and veterans of the global war on terrorism during this devastating time, many of whom are disheartened, distraught, and disappointed. I've also heard from so many Gold Star families who lost their spouses, fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, sons, and daughters during the global war on terrorism. As they've watched the Taliban retake control of Afghanistan, many have even questioned if their family member's sacrifice was worth it. As a fellow veteran of the global war on terrorism, I want them to know that the brave Americans who have kept us safe in the 20 years since September 11, 2001 are heroes, every single one of them. They've succeeded in protecting our citizens and allowing us to enjoy the freedoms and liberties we possess every day. Now more than ever, it's time as we as a nation honor the service members, fallen soldiers, their families, and all those impacted by the global war on terrorism with a national memorial. Since 2017, I've been working across the aisle to create a memorial to those who served in our nation's longest war. I worked with Democratic Senator Joe Manchin to get our bill signed and passed into law to authorize the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation, a private foundation to begin the process of pursuing the construction of a memorial on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. This was the first step in a process that will culminate with the design and construction of a memorial without using any federal funds. Then, earlier this year, I teamed up with my colleague from New Hampshire, Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan, on the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Location Act, which proposed three locations for the memorial on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Last Saturday, we recognized the 20th anniversary of September 11th, the fateful day that forever changed our nation and the lives of so many. But this shouldn't just be a once-a-year exercise. Americans should have the opportunity to honor those brave men and women who took the fight to the terrorists that attacked our nation. They bravely fought to defend our country from future attacks, and in the process, some sacrificed their life and left behind a grieving family. It's for these heroes that we need a Global War on Terrorism Memorial. When folks from my home state of Iowa visit our nation's capital, they should have the opportunity to honor their fellow Iowans and Americans who serve our nation honorably during this war. That includes those who have tragically lost their lives, like Corporal Dagan Williams Tyler Page, who was killed in the Kabul airport bombing and was born in my hometown of Red Oak. The Global War on Terrorism Memorial on our National Mall would be a long-standing testament and reminder of their selflessness for generations to come. On behalf of all my fellow veterans and our service members, I'll keep fighting relentlessly to make this memorial a reality. May God bless the men and women who served and continue to serve the United States of America. And that is a column written by Joni Ernst, U.S. Senator from Iowa. We're going to head over next to the Daily Freeman Journal. The board okays return to learn plan for the Webster City School Board. The Webster City School Board Monday approved the return to learn plan for the fall 2021 school session, but made no decision whether a mask mandate would be implemented after a federal judge issued an injunction to an order issued by Governor Kim Reynolds in May. The court ordered the state of Iowa to immediately halt enforcement of a law that prevents school boards from ordering masks to be worn to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Board member Rich Stroner asked if Superintendent Dr. Mandy Ross was prepared to discuss the matter Monday. "I haven't received any guidance on this," Ross said, "and we need to have some guidance." Ross said she hadn't yet had time to review the ruling handed down by Judge Robert Pratt on Monday. "At this point in time, I would recommend that we postpone the matter until the next board meeting or have a special meeting to discuss it," Ross said. "I've already received phone calls about this," Stroner told the board. Board member Marlon Prusman reported that he had talked to Cindy Sweetler, one of the district's school nurses. "I asked her how things were going at school with regards to COVID. She told me her biggest disappointment was parents who had tested positive and failed to relay that information and still sent their children to school after they showed some symptoms. We need to get the word out that if you test positive, let the school know." Stroner related the story of a person who had tested negative on the rapid test, but then tested positive on the PCR. "The person is asymptomatic and has infected other family members," Stroner said, adding that the family believes it was an asymptomatic student who brought the virus home. "We need to be really cautious, and I hope people will report when they test positive, but I'm hearing that a lot of parents aren't." Stroner said people are taking the rapid test at home themselves. "They don't have to tell anyone, and that's a scary thing," he said. "We just had to keep sending the same message, be honest," Persman said. The updated return to learn plan was approved by the board Monday night. With the conflicting information on masks, it's going to be a fluid situation again this year, Ross told the board. She said the district strongly encourages and supports the wearing of masks by students and staff. "We're also hearing that face coverings last year also reduced the incidence of flu in the community," she said. The superintendent said the district is still working on social distancing plans. Online learning options are not available this year, but for those quarantined at home, the district is providing instructional environments for them while they are at home. Free breakfasts and lunches will continue to be offered throughout the year for all students, Ross said, but families and staff members with outstanding meal accounts from the past will still have to pay those. "It doesn't backfill those outstanding accounts," she said. Ross said the district continues to use the electrostatic cleaning processes used last year. She said the district had reestablished the COVID dashboard on the district website. Ross also said students and staff should not take Tylenol and other fever-reducing medications before coming to school. Fever is one of the symptoms of COVID, and if you're running a fever, you still have the ability to infect other people, she said. She encouraged students to bring a doctor's note if they have sinus infections, colds, and other illnesses that may present much like COVID. "Honestly, that will help us out a lot, and we won't have to worry if they're positive or not," she said. The return to learn plan will be placed on the district website so families can access the full document. "If there are updates, we'll bring it back to the board. As Rich Stoner pointed out, I think we're going to have a changing environment again," said Ross. In other business, the board approved professional development contracts with Solution Tree and Compass PD, accepted two gifts to the district, one in the amount of $500 from the family of Mark Vance in honor of his love of Lynx athletics, and one from Arlo Van Dees for the purchase of a timing system for the Lynx cross-country and track and field programs. Approved funding requests for the Webster City FFA Chapter, High School Spanish Club, and Middle School Choir. Approved the contract recommendation of Sunshine Duffy as an elementary paraeducator. Approved the disposal of two sets of outdated curriculum material. approved the survey for the rental house at Blairsburg, which is currently on the market, and approved lane changes for 5 teachers who have met the required criteria. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we will turn to today's obituary page. Vernon Hoover. Vernon E. Hoover, 85, of Fort Dodge, died Friday, September 10th. Services are 1 p.m. Friday, September 17th at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel. Interment to follow in Corpus Christi Cemetery with military honors presented by the United States Army and the VFW Post 1856. Visitation is 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 16th at Gunderson Funeral Home. And cremation services. Additional information is available at GundersonFuneralHome.com. The family requests in lieu of flowers, memorial donations would be appreciated. He is survived by his wife, Joanne, 7 children, Ronald Hoover, Ronette McCauley, Kenneth Hoover, Kyle Hoover, Dennis Hoover, Devin Hoover, and Brenda Spencer, 17 grandchildren, 21 great-grandchildren, and 1 great-grandchild, great-great-grandchild, excuse me. Vernon and Joanne were longtime owners of Flowers by Vernon. From Pocahontas, Barbara Mayberry. Barbara Mayberry, 100, of Pocahontas, died Wednesday, August 25th at Northgate Care Center in Waukon. Graveside services are 10 a.m. Saturday, September 18th at Summit Hill Cemetery in Pocahontas. There will be no visitation. Powers Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Betty Rode. Betty L. Rode, 77, of Fort Dodge, died Sunday, September 12th at the Marion Home. Funeral services are 10 a.m. Saturday, September 18th at Trinity United Methodist Church with the Reverend Jenna Finch Manchester officiating. Burial in North Lawn Cemetery. Visitation Friday from 5 to 8 at Laufesweiler Funeral Home. The family requests everyone to please wear a mask as COVID-19 is still prevalent. Laufesweiler Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Lake City, Gene Richardson. Gene Richardson, 92, died Friday, September 10th at Shady Oaks Care Center in Lake City. Visitation is 5 to 7 on Tuesday, September 14th. Graveside services and burial 10:30 Wednesday at Lake City Cemetery in Lake City. The visitation is Lampy and Powers Funeral Home in Lake City. Donald Carroll. Donald Carroll died surrounded by his family on Sunday, September 12th. Celebration of life service will be held at a later date. He was 81 years old. Oakcrest Funeral Service is in charge of arrangements. And that concludes today's look at the obituary page.
Sean Halber is joining the ranks of the Fort Dodge Fire Department as an emergency medical technician. The city council hired him Monday. He is a 2015 graduate of Fort Dodge Senior High who worked as a certified nursing assistant at Friendship Haven from April 2015 through 2017 in December. He most recently worked as an EMT with Southeast Iowa Ambulance in Iowa City. He has an associate degree from Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids. The Friends of Webster County Conservation are having a fundraiser. They are holding the Call of the Wild fundraiser from 3 to 6 on Sunday at Camp Winoki. There will be a picnic, meal, silent auction, door prizes, and challenge course. Water and lemonade will be provided. Those attending may bring their own pop, beer, wine, etc. Tickets are $10 per person with children 12 and under free. Call 576-4258 by Wednesday to purchase tickets. We'll head back to the Daily Freeman Journal and look for our next story there. From the Daily Freeman Journal in Webster City, the FFA is going to be serving a pork burger meal. Pork burgers will be on the menu, on the grill, Friday night as the Webster City FFA prepares a meal in conjunction with the Doodle Bug Reunion in Webster City. The public is invited to join reunion attendees for a pork burger meal at the Hamilton County Fairgrounds. The meal includes a pork burger, baked beans, potato salad, and beverage for $5, serving from 5 to 7. All proceeds will go to the Webster City FFA chapter. The Food Bank of Iowa will make a stop. The Food Bank of Iowa Mobile Food Pantry will make a stop in Jewell Thursday, September 23rd from 4 to 6:30. The food distribution will be held at the Bethesda Lutheran Church on Main Street in Jewell. Organizers invited all who may need extra food for their family to attend. Distribution will once again be a drive-through situation. Those attending can pull up to the main door of the church and wait in the car. Volunteers will bring the food out to the vehicle. We're going to head over to the Marshalltown Times-Republican for more stories. An unvaccinated ER nurse barely survives COVID-19. Julie Stevens is a registered nurse in the emergency department at Unity Point Health Marshalltown, and she found herself in a familiar surrounding in August. However, now she was the patient. Stevens chose not to receive a COVID-19 vaccination and had contracted the virus. Because she was a healthy 39-year-old with no underlying health concerns, she tried to manage things at home. Soon, though, a trip to the ER in Marshalltown was necessary and a hospital admission came next. Through the next 2 weeks, Stevens' situation grew grim and she fought for survival. When she needed intensive care, she was transferred to Ames, where she was intubated and placed on a ventilator. Meanwhile, her care team stayed in contact with Unity Point Health in Des Moines in case she required dire action such as extracorporeal membrane oxygenation treatments. In between fighting for breaths of air, Stevens found time to think. I was lying there thinking, why didn't I get the vaccine? Of course, at that point, it's too late. I'm getting ready to be put on a vent. Number two was this. I have two teenage daughters. I wondered who's going to care for my kids. I'm not going to be there for their weddings, for their graduation, you know, those things. Fortunately, Stevens finally took a turn for the better. After 15 days of hospitalization, she was discharged to home on oxygen and is weaning herself from it. Still, she emerged from the battle convicted about the decision she made not to get vaccinated. That's because her husband, Tavius, also contracted COVID-19 but had chosen to be vaccinated. His symptoms were limited to a low-grade fever and some body aches. My big thing is to try and take the politics out of the vaccination. Having a career in health means we believe in the science. It's been proven that people with the vaccine are way less likely to end up in a situation like mine. Stephen's battle began with a fever and severe pain. Pain like I never felt before, she said. My skin even hurt. After being admitted to Unity Point Health in Marshalltown, she was placed on regular oxygen. However, that wasn't sufficient, and she was transferred to an ICU. Once there, her oxygen levels plummeted into the 60% range. Typically, anyone below 92% of demonstrating significant respiratory labor, such as rapid respirations, is cause for hospitalization. Her heart went into VTAC, or ventricular tachycardia, a heart rhythm disorder. Typically, patients in VTAC have their hearts shocked back into rhythm. Medication helped get Stevens' heart in rhythm, but she was on a high-flow nasal cannula oxygenation, receiving 15 liters of oxygen per minute, which is the highest a patient can get, and still her oxygen levels were only in the 70s. The ICU pulled in the hospitalist and the critical care, pulmonology and infectious disease departments. They decided to intubate Stevens and plan for potential ECMO treatments, which is when a machine is used to bypass lungs in order to enhance blood oxygenation. When people go on ECMO, it's typically for weeks. The intubation and ventilator helped stabilize Stevens. She was discharged at the end of August and is expected to make a full recovery. She remains off work, and should her recovery plateau, a pulmonologist will need to explore whether she suffered long-term lung damage. Really, my thing is, if I can just make one person realize how important the vaccine is, then I feel like I've done my job, Stevens said. I think people have a misconception like I did. Number one, I was like, I don't want to get a vaccination because I'm going to feel sick for a couple of days. Well, I would have taken a couple of days of the body aches and fever as opposed to 2 weeks in the hospital with intubation. I mean, I was a healthy 39-year-old. And number two, the vaccination doesn't mean you're not going to get COVID. You can still get COVID, but it should keep you out of the hospital. Stevens is grateful for the care she received in both locations, including from hospitalist Carrie Lisboa and her team in Marshalltown, and her fellow caregivers reached out daily with messages of support while delivering meals when she returned home. Perhaps the most impactful touch point was a reassuring comment from one of the human resources contacts who told Stevens her job would be waiting for her and to concentrate on getting better. Stevens had her reasons for not getting vaccinated, and she hopes she can spare others the dangers associated with making the same decision. A lot of it was, I just didn't want to, and then as soon as Unity Point Health came out and said you have to, then you kind of dig your heels in and say, well, if you say I have to, then I'm not going to. Hindsight is 20/20, but I realize that Unity Point and everybody else are doing it for their staff and patients, Stevens said. I mean, if we're out ill, we can't take care of patients, so it's really not political to me anymore. They're trying to do what's best for staff. Homecoming celebrations will be back to normal. Traditions are back this year with festivities underway as Marshalltown Community School District celebrates homecoming this week. The 2020 COVID-19 pandemic put a stop to the usual plans. Valerie Corson, a Marshalltown High School counselor and co-advisor of the Student Senate, said there is a lot of excitement among students this homecoming season. Last year, she felt the overall theme of homecoming was students trying to make the best of the situation, with this year having the feeling of a comeback. They are very excited to have our traditions back, Corson said. They're just ready to have everything go back to normal. She said the Student Senate was adamant to make this year's homecoming week to feel as close to normal as possible. With minimal changes, this year's homecoming week has a more typical feel. Events such as the parade, powder puff, powder buff games, and homecoming dance all return this week. This year's homecoming thing is Light Up the Night, which is meant to demonstrate the enthusiasm behind the return of homecoming celebrations. It's all just kind of glitz, glamour, glow, just trying to brighten everybody up and bring some excitement, Corson said. Students also participate in theme dress days throughout the week, with Monday being team day where students wear clothing in support of their favorite teams. Corson said students really wanted a day to focus on celebrating themselves and their differences, with Tuesday being diversity day. Students are encouraged on diversity day to dress in a way that shows others who they are. Friday is Bobcat Blackout and Spirit Day, with a blackout is planned for the football game Friday night. Black homecoming t-shirts with Bobcat Blackout on the front are available for the first time. To accommodate the Light Up the Night theme, attendees at Friday's game will have red and blue glow sticks to wave. Candidates for homecoming king and homecoming queen have been announced and will coronation set for 7 o'clock Thursday evening at the Marshalltown High School Roundhouse, but to keep up with COVID-19 mitigation efforts, the event moved outdoors this year. The 2021 Marshalltown High School homecoming court includes queen candidates Bianca Andrade, Rochelle Avalis, Lisbeth Avina, Phoebe Hermanson, Jennifer Mendoza, Kendall C., and Rachel Smith. King candidates are Austin Close, Marco Herrera, Dominic Garth, Emmanuel Gonzalez, Aaron Seeberger, Zeke Slokman, and Gannon Williams. Before coronation will be the homecoming parade at 6 o'clock Thursday evening. Floats representing school activities and student groups will travel down Main Street to 2nd Avenue. The parade's grand marshal will be former Marshalltown High School cross-country coach and athletic director Tim Bell. Bell served as the cross-country coach for 32 years and athletic director for 13 years, coaching 541 cross-country runners. Events capping off homecoming will be the Marshalltown High School football team hosting Fort Dodge at 7:30 Friday night, with a student homecoming dance to follow at 8 o'clock on Saturday night. The Marshalltown Human Rights Commission may be nearing its final days after being adopted in 1984. The City Council discussed repealing Chapter 94 in its Code of Ordinances requiring the city to fill a Human Rights Commission to investigate complaints of violations to the Iowa Civil Rights Act. Cities with a population of more than 29,000 are required to have a local civil rights group, but Marshalltown's population is 27,951, according to the newest census data. City Administrator Jessica Kinzer said the main reasons to dissolve the commission are it is difficult to find people to serve on it, and without members, it is difficult to adequately investigate complaints. We really have not had an active commission for more than 5 years, she said. Kinzer acknowledged Pastor Greg Davison of Trinity Lutheran Church is the lone member of the commission at the moment. It's something that's been near and dear to his heart for many years, she said. The Iowa Civil Rights Commission does call him when they receive complaints of active discrimination in Marshalltown. Kinzer clarified the dissolution of the commission does not mean members of protected classes based on race, heritage, gender, and sexual orientation are not served or representative complaints are made. All complaints of civil rights violations and discrimination are reported to the Iowa Civil Rights Commission. I am very cautious and careful about the perception of taking an avenue away and taking protections away from the community. Over the last few months, there's been more conversations I've been involved in about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the community, and that has had a very positive tone. That is a strain to start to tug on that I definitely think we should have more conversation about in our next strategic planning session. Kinzer said larger cities often have a staff member assigned to handling human rights issues, which may exist within city policies. Those staff members try to remove anything in policy that could create inequity in the community. That's something we as an organization should start looking at too, she said. This is something where a number of organizations are already doing this internally. I do think there is an opportunity to do something at a community level to make sure that we are providing an environment where people feel they are welcome, they feel like they are treated equally, they feel they can be included in decisions that are being made. The council directed staff to bring back a resolution dissolving the commission. The city council approved $29,500 in council-designated local option sales tax for the Riverview Park Master Plan. Previous plans for the park were changed greatly when about 400 trees were damaged in the derecho in 2020. The city unanimously voted to contract Bolton and Menck to analyze the park and develop concepts for its improvement. We have a different situation than what we had when those plans were first designed, Kinzer said. We thought this was now the time before coming to you with a request for future borrowing to look at what is a new vision for Riverview Park, knowing it's our biggest and probably most important park in the community. She said the target for receiving concepts from the engineering firm is January, with the intent of including the park in next year's capital improvement plan discussions. The Marshall County Arts and Cultural Alliance is also eyeing a new master plan. Director Amber Danielson discussed the pros and creating a coordinated plan with the Alliance, city, and other organizations in and around the community. The Arts and Culture Master Plan will align with and contribute to the influential plans and organizations already guiding Marshalltown, said Danielson. Plans like the Downtown Master Plan, Parks and Recreation Plan, Trails Placemaking Plan, the Highway 14 Corridor, all name beautification and public art as priorities and strong recommendations. Danielson said the plan would be an actionable tool used throughout the city to achieve the city's overall strategic goal of adding more public art. The Alliance requested a $5,000 contribution from the city to go to the development of toward the development of the plan. It has already raised $14,000. Councilor Gary Thompson asked whether the plan would include murals on businesses. Danielson answered this would be just one of many ways art would continue to be implemented. The council agreed to include a resolution on the next council agenda approving a $5,000 contribution from council designated lost toward the plan. We're going to go ahead and head over to the Messenger Sports page. Ball Security is the title of the column in today's Messenger, written by Eric Pratt. We are in the golden era of college football scoring, where programs from across the country put up video game-like totals for points and yardage on a regular basis. Average team scoring eclipsed 30 points per game for the first time ever 5 years ago and hasn't looked back. In 2004, 11 squads at the Division I level produced over 450 yards per contest. Last season, that number had more than doubled to 25. Point totals have followed a similar trend. Offenses are more elaborate. Rules are geared toward protecting quarterbacks and rewarding receivers. A scroll through number the numbers will typically find Iowa's offenses around the middle to the bottom of the pack, both in the Big Ten and nationally. The Hawkeyes have never been flashy under head coach Kirk Ferentz. They're not anemic with the ball, mind you, but Hawkeye fans often grumble about Ferentz's predictability, affinity for field position, and conservative play calling. Iowa ranked 8th in the league in total offense in 2020. They were 10th in 2019, 10th in 2018, 10th in 2017. You get the picture, and it's not like the Big Ten is consistently loaded with offensive juggernauts. Currently, Ferentz's squad is 5th from the bottom, small sample size, I know, among the 130 FBS schools in offense. Yet the Hawkeyes are up to 5th nationally with a 2-0 mark after impressive scratch-that-dominant victories over top 20 opponents Indiana and Iowa State. 12 of Iowa's last 14 league seasons have ended with a Big Ten record over the break-even mark. In fact, since 2008, Iowa is 109-57 overall and 66-42 in the conference during that period of time. Ferentz is a 66-year-old leader who has not only established a new lease on his coaching life, but found ways to make his program more consistent than ever at an age when most coaches had long since lost their edge or faded away. How's he doing it? Instead of adjusting to the times, trying to find the trendiest way to update his playbook or revolutionize his offensive approach, Ferentz doubled down on his defense, and the Hawkeyes have never been as steady or relentless on that side of the ball, holding 24 consecutive opponents under 25 points. It's a streak that dates all the way back to November 2018, ranking as the best and longest in the country. Like usual, Iowa isn't necessarily glamorous on the defensive side of the ball, just fundamentally sound, all but refusing to give up big plays or make mistakes under widely respected coordinator Phil Parker. The Hawkeyes' punting game, typically an even more boring topic of conversation for most fans than defense, is every bit as dangerous of a weapon in this day and age. Torrey Taylor is nothing short of remarkable. He ranks 6th in the country for distance, but also has a deft touch in pinning opponents inside their 20 or even 10-yard line, an invaluable asset which, again, isn't always prioritized by other collegiate programs. Embrace the mundane, your choice. The Hawks will chug along at times offensively, laboring to pick up first downs while keeping possessions close to the vest. Ferentz doesn't care about rapid-fire points. He wants to grind opponents down, frustrating skill position stars, and eventually breaking both their spirit and will. Former Iowa fullback Brady Ross, an ex-Humboldt All-Stater who currently works in the Algona area, said it best during a recent text conversation. If you can punt well, play defense well, and take care of the ball, man, it's really hard to lose against the vast majority of teams. Iowa is the equivalent of a Major League Baseball franchise with a powerful starting rotation, lockdown bullpen, and steady infield and outfield play. Sure, it may be fun to see home runs and scoring galore, but that type of action is more for June and July entertainment rather than October playoff advancement. When push comes to shove, the Hawkeyes won't wow people or win pretty. At crunch time, though, they know who they are and are perfectly comfortable being something most programs aren't. And that is today's Messenger column from Eric Pratt. We'll head back to the main sports section. The Iowa Central rugby team went out to West Point, New York to take on the Army rugby team. They lost by a score of 40-12. They were out there on a weekend honoring those of the September 11th attacks on the United States. The top-ranked Iowa Central rugby team made a special visit to face off against Army. It's tough to go a long way and perform as we did, said head coach Brent Nelson. We're obviously disappointed in that, in the outcome, but those guys are resilient and will learn from this and bounce back. Honestly, I think they were in a bit of shock because of how in-your-face Army was. We watched film and scouted them, but until you are on the pitch, it's hard to respond. We had some good rugby moments. Hopefully that 20 years from now, these guys reflect back on this trip for all that it included. Iowa Central returns to action Saturday in Minnesota. We'll look real quick at this date in history. On this date in 1814, Francis Scott Key penned the Star Spangled Banner. In 2015, a Muslim teen was arrested for bringing a reassembled clock to school. I think it was a little bit more than a reassembled clock. But that's what they say here. 1927, dancer Isadora Duncan is killed in a car accident. 1964, John Steinbeck was awarded the Medal of Freedom. In 1974, I Shot the Sheriff hits the song charts. 1982, Hollywood star and real-life princess Grace Kelly died. In 1862, the North and South clashed at the Battle of South Mountain. In 1959, a Soviet probe reached the moon. In 1812, Napoleon entered Moscow. In 1847, General Winfield Scott captured Mexico City. In 1999, millions fled from Hurricane Floyd. In 1975, Elizabeth Ann Seton becomes first American-born saint. On this date in 1901, President McKinley died of infection from gunshot wounds. And on this date in 1944, the Americans launch Operation Stalemate at an extraordinary cost. And that's just a handful of things that happen on this date on September 14th. We'll take a look next at the forecast for the next 10 days real quickly. Wednesday looks sunny, high of 80, on a low of 62. Thursday, high of 86, low of 63. Friday, a high of 69 with scattered thunderstorms and possibly a half an inch of rain. Low of 58. Saturday, high of 82, low of 66 with morning thunderstorms. Sunday, sunny, high of 90, low of 66. Sunny on Monday, high of 89, low of 67. Tuesday, high of 83, low of 57. Wednesday, the 22nd, high of 69, low of 51. On Thursday, a high of 71 and a low of 54. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they're calling for partly cloudy skies. That's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger with some help from the Daily Freeman Journal of Webster City and the Marshalltown Times Republican. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thank you so much for sharing this time with me. Of course, this podcast and many other podcasts are available to you at iowaradioreading.org, and we thank you for your continued support of IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Stay safe, stay healthy, take good care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you again real soon right here on IRIS. Bye-bye for now.